Okay, welcome task force members and guests. I'm going to call to order this April 16th, 2014 meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on Apprenticeship in State Contracting meeting. And I'm really excited to be here in beautiful Tangent in this facility, which we are going to be touring after the meeting, for those of you who are available and interested. And we are going to hear some more about how a training center like this works and fits into the overall apprenticeship scheme. We're going to do that as part of the informational meeting. And then we're going to be talking about some of the outstanding issues that remain before us on the task force and talk about next steps. Before we do that, though, why don't we just go around the room, just kind of remind ourselves who we are, starting with John.
John Molis, Oregon Building Trades Council.
Rod Belisle, I'm the director of the NEEC IBW Training Center in Portland.
Tom Girding, Girding Companies.
Ron Robbins, Pacific Northwest Carpenters.
Gene Kidd, Operating Engineers, Local 701.
Mark Johnson, State Representative for House District 52, and I live in Hood River.
Katty McEwen, Representative from House District 9 over on the South Coast, Coos Bay to Yahats.
Patrick Brennan, Task Force Staff.
Michael Dembro, State Senator for District 23, that's Northeast and Southeast Portland.
Sandy Trainer, Kodiak Pacific Construction.
And Carl Redman with Bear Electric.
Barry Jones, Department of Administrative Services, the Construction Manager.
Zoe? Okay. Mike, and why don't we have the guests introduce themselves, too? Mike, you're not a guest, but you can introduce yourself.
Nick Suing, just an apprentice, the peer apprentice.
Great, thanks.
Dave Baker, Training Director, St. Portland Training Center.
Tim Brew, Business Manager, Local 280. Chris Lofton, German Wireman, Local 280, Trustee for Business.
Brian Creek, Focus
Point Communications, here for PMCA, SMACNA, and
others. Sean Miller, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and Independent Electrical Contractors.
Anna
Brown with Foley.
Paul Holby, State Representative from District
8,
which is Eugene.
Jack Dempsey, the National Construction Alliance and the Carpenters.
Pat Lummi with Tice Electric Company.
Brian Trivett with PacWest Communications, here for Building Trades, NECA, Wall and Ceiling Contractors, IBW 280.
Corey Johnson, PacWest.
Okay. Great. And on the phone?
This is Kathleen Massier with the City of Portland.
Okay, thank you, Kathleen. Okay, Patrick, why don't you just walk us through the agenda before we get started?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to hear from the folks who are hosting us today from the IBW Training Center here. I think the folks sitting in the back corner who just introduced themselves will be appearing for us, and we'll get a chance to hear kind of what they do here, their experiences here, and then have a chance for some Q&A with them. The second thing on the agenda, I'm looking at Ryan. We had planned to have Nathan. Pat's going to do that today. So they're going to introduce. They're going to talk a little bit about a concept that they would like to bring for the committee as offer some discussion. And then the third thing that we have listed during our recorded portion of the meeting will be kind of a discussion of issues that we want to make sure are on our in front of the committee task force rather, so we can build a work plan for the remaining portion of the interim to work on. Make sure we get everything on the table so we know we're not missing anything that members of this group wanted to have the task force consider. The co-chairs will use that to build the work plan for the rest of the meeting time of the interim, and we'll develop committee agendas from there, and then we'll break and take a field trip for the facility.
That's great. So before we go into the first agenda item, I just want to say you know, there is a lot of interest in apprenticeship right now, a growing interest in apprenticeship, I think, in this state and around the country. As many of you know, we passed legislation during the short session that calls out apprenticeship as a part of the state's 40-40-20 goals That is as a key part of what's known as that middle 40, that to show that apprenticeship is a key part of what we think of as higher education in this state. Just last week, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which I sit on and so does Paul Holby, heard a report from Steve Sims from Boley on apprenticeship. And, you know, apprenticeship has just not really been on the radar for our state Workforce Investment Board. And there was a great deal of excitement, I have to say, and interest on the part of the Workforce Investment Board members. And, so I think that we're going to see that. We're going to see growing interest in the apprenticeship model and looking for ways in which that model of not only building the workforce but delivering education can be applied more broadly within employment in the state. And then finally, you may have heard that President Obama is talking about investing a significant amount of money in apprenticeship on a national level. And, you know, I don't think we've actually seen the details of that yet, but he's talking about several hundred million dollars of investment. And if that happens, I think that could do some remarkable things. And we're going to want to make sure we get a piece of the action. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's move on then to our informational meeting and hear from our friends here at the Training Center. Dave, did you have a – were you going to lead that? That would be great. So I'll ask you to do one thing, and that's just identify yourself for the record. You don't have to give your address, just who you are, because this is being recorded, and we want to know who's saying what.
Yeah, Dave Baker, Central Electrical Training Center Training Director.
Nick Suing, Central Electrical Training Center Apprentice.
Rich Lofton, Journeyman Electrician, IBW Local 280, Trustee for the facility.
Yeah. Well,
start from the beginning.
Okay.
Can I start?
Can I see a hand? Who was an apprentice in this room?
Sometime somewhere. So about what?
20%, roughly. Okay, just curious.
Thought you had more than that.
I will.
Okay. So
I'm gonna mull all that.
I guess I'll ask the chair. Where would you like me to start, or how far in detail you want me to go?
I'd like you to tell us about this facility.
Okay.
And, you know, just what all is included here, what your stats are, but, you know, then also just how a facility like this is typical or not typical of the training world.
Okay, good. So back in October 2000 is when this facility was opened and on Tangent, and it was due to the interaction of A&T contributions that we maintain from our members through our employers. So this building is funded by our action working out in the field. And so we came together and decided that having our own facility to kind of do our own training was warranted. So back in 2000, we purchased the land, built the building, and we've been here ever since. So we were actually housing classes in outlying community colleges or high schools, and that's when I went through the apprenticeship program, and I graduated in 2000. That's where my training was at. And so we were kind of a welcome guest, but we really weren't able to set up training facilities like you'll see today when we go around here. So from that point, I think we probably had roughly 120 or so apprentices in three programs. We have a two-year residential program, a three-year limited energy program, and a five-year general journeyman inside program. And we quickly grew over the years, filling the manpower needs as our economy grew and our membership grew. And we reached about 270 apprentices back in about 2007 before the economy kind of started going south. And we've been downward ever since, but we're starting to see a little bit of recovery. We are now back up to 107 apprentices. We were down below 90 the start of the fall. So we our hiring sessions the last couple of years have been pretty poor, but they're getting back to where they're at. And the way this operation functions is we actually have a selection process that we work with the Bureau of Labor and Industry. We have our own set of standards as a registered apprenticeship program. So if anyone's interested in becoming an apprentice, they'll contact our office. We work with them to get their application put together, submitted by a timely fashion, and we accept applications year-round, and we actually process them every 3 to 4 months. And then they have to meet minimum qualifications, age, GPA, math requirements. And if they meet the qualifications, we put them through an aptitude exam that measures reading comprehension and math skills, and it's a national test put out that NJTCs for the IBW use. Our JTCs for the IBW use across the country. So it's a standardized test that we use to see if they're going to be suited for the apprenticeship trade and being an electrician. It's a measurement to see if you have the capabilities to succeed in our apprenticeship. And if they do that, then they qualify for a panel interview, which they come back a third time, and they sit before a group of 2 to 5 people, contractors and electricians like myself, instructors that we volunteer our time to interview them. And from there, they go into a ranked pool. The highest number is the top of the pool, and when we have an opening that we cannot fill, all our apprentices are working, we then will draft someone from that pool, and they begin the apprenticeship program in the work field area. And then in the fall, they come back to school. So our school system is a lot like most high schools and colleges. So we start after Labor Day, and we finish up right before Memorial Day. And we have regular days off like school programs do, and the students start the school in the fall. So the bulk of their training will be out there in the field. You need to attain about 2,000 hours a year of related training in the field, working on projects, doing electrical construction. So when they come into a building, start to finish, they'll see the entire project. They learn the system, how to come in journeyman. And as they're gaining skills and knowledge, they progress, they get raises, they get more responsibility, and they progress from 1 year to the next. And they are on their way. It's a pathway to become a journeyman. Apprenticeship is not a permanent position. It's a system to get to become your journeyman card, and that's when you then become the person that usually ends up training apprentices as well. So the apprentice works as a tool partner with people in the field, gaining hours, and they come to school one or two nights a week, and then one Saturday every month to get the behind-the-scenes theory training and some hands-on training you'll see today when we walk around here. So they get a little broad base of everything. So we want to make sure that they're progressing. And then each stage we have of the apprenticeship, we actually have 3 levels of testing to make sure that they are achieving where we want them to be at each year. So they'll test them in our code proficiency. We'll test them on hands-on to make sure that they should have attained this amount of hands-on training in the field. If they can't, we can address that. And also, we have NJTC material that's a national curriculum that we follow, so it's homework as well. So these students put in about 220 hours of training at night over the course of the year. So they're here 3 hours, 3.5 hours every night after a full day of work. So as we call it, a full-time job, part-time school. And when they come out of here, they have a good accreditation from the national curriculum. They get their journeyman's card, get licensed profession, and they begin their career as a journeyman.
May I ask a couple questions?
Yes, please.
Michael? Thank you. What is your average wait time once people are accepted onto the waiting list? How long do they sit there before they're brought in?
Well, through the chair, it could be the next day if we have openings, or it could be 2 years and we don't get to them. Because at the highest score, 100 being the best, they're the most suited for the program by our measurement, the way we kind of interact, seeing their resume, their application, their backgrounds and education and field work, and then that's how they get slotted. So right now we have interviews coming up May 13th. I have 3 open calls right now. So from that interview process, 3 people will get a call the next morning, and we got a job for them ready to go. And it's at this time of the year, it's kind of unusual that we hire during this time of the season, but because we've had a attrition rate, it's positive. But if you have a number that's a little lower, you know, say if your number puts you like number 35 on the list to be hired, that means the fact that we'd have to hire 34 people before we get to you. So the number that they receive from the interview process is a good 2 years that they can sit on that number and exhaust it. So it's open.
What level of math would you expect a student coming out of high school to have that would prepare them to meet your entrance requirements?
To make the bare minimum, you have to have algebra.
Algebra 2 or Algebra 1?
Algebra 1.
Algebra
you
one.
Have to have, and Rod can correct me if I'm going to hit something wrong here. I think you have to have two full semesters of C or better of algebra. And I'll be honest with you, that is the bare minimum. Our math skills, we look at people, if they can attain trigonometry and calculus, they're going to be better suited for what we do. To hit the bare minimum means you can get to the interview process. You know, we're looking for the highest candidates with the highest amount of education behind them. We have people that come with degrees into our program.
Sure. And do you have an idea? Oh, I'm
sorry. Excuse me, Katie. Kathleen, could you put your phone on mute? We have some noise coming through.
Star 6.
Oh. Okay. Go ahead.
This interests me because it's a world I worked in for a while, and so the preparation as they approach entrance into your program is very interesting to me. Do you have an idea of what the kind of the balance would be between your high school graduating seniors applying for your programs or people coming in from another aspect of a different work life or changing directions later? How many are right out of high school?
Not as many as we like, to be honest with you. If we pick a student that's probably up below the age of 20, what usually have attracted our attention is they have shop classes, have a job through the summer years, coming through high school, and good grades. Do they have volunteer projects under their belt? Maybe they're Eagle Scout, work for Habitat. They have to come with a list of stuff that really tracks to what we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons why we do more interaction with high schools is try to get the younger age students interested in a career that we have. And it's not typical that we don't pick 18-year-olds, but we do have in our first-year classes people that are 18 up to about 45 in a first-year class.
Okay.
So it's challenging for them to make sure they get those measures, but by being interviewed by fellow electricians and contractors, employers, we know what we see is suitable.
You may have math fresh in the brain, which is a good thing coming straight out of school. Yeah, that's helpful. And the geographic range that you cover, how big an area do you draw to this facility?
We start from Woodburn all the way down to Cottage Grove and over into Central Oregon, Redmond area, Bend, Redmond, and Prineville.
No, there's the revitalization of what we used to call vocational technical programs in our high school is something that we've been taking quite seriously and are pushing really hard to try and revitalize those programs. So hopefully we'll be able to have an impact on what's flowing your way within a few years if we can continue to be successful with what we're trying to do. So.
And for your information, for the last 5 or 7 years, we've had great partnerships with the Youth Build. That's in our area. We interact with Corvallis High School, Benton School District, Lynn School Districts, and we were a part of a grant process last year with Regional Trades Academy, and our partnership is just growing. We're now branching out into Salem area and the Eugene Springfield schools as well, and we were actually in a mobile training program down there where our instructor goes down there and provides about 40 hours of related training of what we do to show them what the career choices are, and it's having an impact. The frustrating thing that I experienced when I first started as a training director is a counselor that was involved with a school closest to us called for directions on how to get here. And so that kind of rang a bell and say, if she doesn't know where we're at, how do her students know who we are? And so from that, we actually have done very well working with all the schools to bring them in here. And today is not a day they're here today. I was hoping we could have hit it right where you could have seen the high school kids from South and West Albany spending a couple hours of their school time being bused here to do some training that we do.
That's great. So you're seeing those inroads beginning to be successful?
Absolutely.
Good.
And it's been a great benefit. My instructors are reborn. I mean, to interact with adults in the electrical apprenticeship world is a great task that they do, and it's a great outcome. It's a good position to have. But seeing them interact with high school kids and their energy, it's been amazing to see the transformation of my instructors.
Maybe we can keep moving that dial. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, Rick Johnson.
Thanks, Chair. Who makes and how is the decision made about how many available slots that you have? I think you mentioned you might have hit a high water mark about 270 at one point in time and went down to as low as 90. How is that determination made about how many applicants can get into the program?
Well, through the chair, Mr. Johnson, what we do is buy basically contractor demand and work needs. And so if our contractor is able to put together a team on a job site, requires two apprentices for a crew of 12, what they'll do is demand that. And if they only have one available, then they contact us. And so we work with our contractors to man the work that's in our area. So if we only need 15 new apprentices that year, we will start 15, and we won't start 20 in anticipation of any other issue that might come up. We want to make sure we man the work we have available to us. So every year it's kind of directed by a contractor's call for manpower needs. And usually the call starts with, I need an apprentice such and such location for a duration of this period. And if we have one available, it's on our out-of-work list in that area, without question, they go to them first, regardless of their training, and they go out there and work for that contractor. If none are available in that area, then we'll pull someone in brand new. And we work with our trust, our JATC committee, which Rich and Tim are a part of, and Mr. Phillips is as well, and we communicate back and forth to make sure that we do not overload our system with unneeded apprentices. It's very important that we don't have a lot of apprentices that aren't working. So that doesn't help them at all.
I guess I would say the flip side, though, it would make makes the system hard to ramp up when demand occurs if we have to wait for someone to come through a program to get certified as an apprentice. Is that not correct?
Through the chair, Mr. Johnson, we have a list of 200 people that within 2 weeks I can start half of them. You know, so it is kind of I know when the contractor calls, they usually want someone there the next morning, and so it's kind of I wish I could get someone there, but the reality is when we have a new hire, we want to make sure that they have time to quit their position, give a two-week notice to come in. You know, and I've always said it'd be nice if we had a small group of apprentices that were available for work, but as long as that apprentice list didn't, where they're waiting too long to be going back for the next job. It's not a perfect system. It's basically we're at the behest of the economy. Because when we had a slow downturn, we went from full employment to about 46 apprentices out of work out of a total of 270, and they stayed there for a while. So having that excessive amount of apprentices, it damaged their ability to graduate on time, which is very important to us.
Rich? Yeah, Rich?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I was going to almost address exactly what Dave was talking about when Representative McEwen asked him about how the process worked. Dave was giving you today's picture, a fairly rosy picture, but 5 years ago when we had, you know, 30%, 40% unemployment in the apprenticeship, that's awful hard to have these guys come down here and take a lower paying job sometimes from the private sector to come into our program. Now you get to sit and wait because we overloaded a job in anticipation of more work, and that didn't happen. So Rod, I'm sure, is facing that reality right now with certain projects he has up in his area. That you know, the demand for the apprentices are there. What happens when that stops? Does he have 200 apprentices that he can't do anything with? You know, so that's a very real thing to those of us that have been through apprenticeship and our journeymen and our trustees and involved in this. That's why I ask for a show of hands, who's been an apprentice? Because it's a different world. And a wise man told me, a wise man that I often disagreed with, a guy by the name of A.J. Pearson, he asked us what the difference was between a tradesman and a professional, because we all thought we were professional electricians. No, we're not. We're tradesmen. We share our knowledge. I'll take an apprentice like Nick, and I will show him what I know. I don't hold anything back. It's not like the professional community. I give him everything I have if I got to work with him. And that's what we do for our apprentices. That's what many journeymen did for me when I was an apprentice. So whenever we talk about apprentices, we just need to know that it's a little bit different world out there. And we've got to tread very carefully on our numbers, how we go about the process of getting the right numbers. All of us want to see it grow. Don't get me wrong. But we have to grow it responsibly. Thank you.
Yes. Tom?
I have a question along that vein. So, in your opinion, is there one of the pieces that the task force will be looking at is whether it's realistic to place percentage goals for apprenticeship or requirements or all those varying sorts of things? Is in your opinion the risk of potentially having a threshold required for apprenticeships that starts generating too many apprentices pushing journeymen out of work? or from a ratio standpoint on that? Have you all looked at that, and in your opinion, is that a concern? Or
through the chair, Mr. Girding, I believe it is, and I think one of the issues I see is all jobs come to an end. You know, and if so, if they're going to mandate that we have to have 40% of these hours put together by apprentices, it's kind of hard to make that a blanket statement for all contractors, all jobs. And I can use two examples of one contractor that they utilize each crew as two apprentices and eight journeymen. That's what they do standard. And then what they do that for is they want to make sure all the apprentices that are working for them get properly trained and rotated within that crew, that they can see as many different variations of training as they can get. And I have another company that they'll maximize their apprenticeship ratios to the fullest. And what I get is a balance of making sure these apprentices are properly working steadily, getting their hours towards completion, and we don't have a large downturn if that job does kind of ramp down. I have all these overloaded apprentices that were needed for the job. Two larger jobs we had in our sector opened up, and they were calling for 40 apprentices in the Prineville area, and that's unsustainable. That we never really had more than 15 or 20 apprentices at any one time over there at any one time in our career, but to blow it up with 35, 40 requested apprentices when the job shut down, I'd be now left with that many that I have no work for. So we've been struggling to keep the six or seven we have over there now working. So it's kind of, I know it's a need to kind of, this is what we look at, but a measure probably a little bit is a little cleaner than a straight line percentage might be better suited for my needs.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please.
If I may address also Mr. Girding's question, as the apprenticeship here, we're not as concerned about the journeyman that's being displaced. We're worried about the 30-40% of the apprentices that we're going to displace if we overload the system. Because the journeyman, that's our name, journeyman, we have the ability to travel somewhere. Our apprentices, they're here. They can't go to South Dakota. They can't go to Texas to go work, you know, in a normal state of business, where the journeyman can. We're more worried about that apprentice that could be stuck here like we were 3, 4, 5 years ago at 30% unemployment. That's where we were going with. We got to be careful about not overloading the system.
Mm-hmm. But not to be leading you.
That's okay.
Who's the best judge of determining what the appropriate apprenticeship level is?
I'd love to say we are, but you know, we have to also put our trustee hats on and what's good for our industry. You know, there's a lot of times, this year being one of them, when Representative McEwen asked that question, yeah, we're having a pretty good year. We're starting a lot of apprentices. Guys like me, I get a little nervous. But I'm willing to put my trustee hat on and say, yes, we do need to put more guys on, even though I don't really want to. But I'm going to, because it's for the good of the industry.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, if I could speak to that concept, I have a board of trustees that manages our training center, and we regularly look at numbers of members that retire on an annual basis. And that number, almost regardless of the economy, doesn't change a lot. And so we've seen over the last 15 years that number to be pretty stable. We look at our market that we have in our jurisdiction, how much of the work that is electrical that we do, and that market number, we track that. And so we use those figures along with graduation rates and incoming apprentice rates, and then compile all that and then make rational decisions on how many apprentices come into the program. And again, that would be, you know, Dave mentioned Prineville, we have a large employer out in Hillsboro right now, giant facility, and every employer out there would probably take 20 more apprentices if I offered them. But when that job's over, that would result to probably 200 apprentices that I don't have to place. And so we have to kind of put those jobs aside and look at our plan. And our plan is going to be the same regardless of what's being built that day, because it's a five-year apprenticeship program. And ultimately, over the course of 5 years, we will build and we will grow and develop. But to pinpoint a specific job and use that as a determining factor for the number of apprentices definitely can create some problems in the long term. So.
Yeah,
not to get too bogged down in this topic, but I think it's an important one. And when Rod said his board of trustees, I'm quite sure he meant his JATC, which is equally made up of labor and management members. And so that's kind of the beauty in our system, is we have between the two sides, we try to find that balance of what's the right number for our industry. And from the union's perspective, we don't want to have too many apprentices, because then you have them sitting out of work. You've invested maybe 6 months or 2 years or 3 years in them, and they're out of work so much they get discouraged and they leave the industry after we've invested a bunch of money in them. And from the management's perspective, you know, they don't want to be shorthanded either, and we respect that point of view too. So it's a really fine balance that we try and find together with our management partners. It's not easy, but we spend a lot of time and effort trying to do it for the best of the industry.
And just to remind you that, you know, the focus of this task force is public projects, right? And your training centers are turning out apprentices for public projects and private projects as well. You know, I think the basic value behind this task force is, you know, that the state has a commitment to apprenticeship and wants to make sure that in the projects that it's funding, there be apprentices included. And, you know, so I mean, I think that's a value that we need to be thinking about, along with this other value, which is very legitimate, about sustainability. And, you know, we're not just interested in how many apprentices are coming in. We want to see them making it all the way to journeyman status. Nick, is there... Can you talk to us about what this whole experience is like from your perspective as an apprentice?
Yeah, I would. I'd say it's fairly stressful at some points. You're working hard to work yourself out of work, pretty much, is what the idea is, and hopefully, usually there's another job that you can go to and do the same thing. But I do. I mean, I know they keep bringing up when we had a big, heavy load of apprentices, and that was pretty catastrophic. A lot of people were out of work. So when you do get those big, large amounts of people coming in and no work, it was really tough. Other than that, I have been... I think most apprentices have stayed fairly busy going from job to job, whether it's with one employer or several employers. You're pretty mobile.
Tell us about what got you interested in apprenticeship and what prepared you for it. How long have you been an apprentice?
I've actually been in for 6 years. I went back to Ohio for a year with some family issues, so I kind of took a year off here and worked in the trade back there. What got me interested in it was I was talking with a couple people. They were talking about how they enjoyed the work, and so it was up my alley. I went to OSU and LB for 3 years for mechanical engineering, kind of got tuckered out, bought a house. So I had the math background, the chemistry background, then decided to try something different and started here. But I did hear about this program through an electrician. So then I guess maybe to answer your question on the waiting time, I think I waited 2 weeks after that. I took my test to get in. It was fairly quick, and I think I actually took 2 weeks so I could give my 2 week notice for my other employer, and ever since just been kind of trucking along.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please, Sandy.
You talked about having to work on a variety of different jobs. How long was the shortest job, and how long was the longest job? I guess that's my first question.
As far as the shortest job, are you talking for
working for an employer?
In
the field.
My time with the employer, or just a job that I've worked for, or
as an apprentice?
Okay, I would say the shortest job would be and a day. I guess you could be called out for a day. I worked on one job, well, actually two jobs for about 2 years. There were some pretty big jobs. One was just GP Eugene. Right off 99, there's a resin plant that they kind of redid their whole system, and we just finished that up. So so you get a quite a variety of time. I mean, you some maybe a month long, but...
Do you find that you get a variety of different types of jobs, and there is a learning curve when you move from company to company about the type of job and the type of work?
There's definitely a learning curve. My work history has been very consistent. I've worked for a farmer. I worked, I want to say, 9 years for him. Developed a great relationship with him. I also, through high school and college, did janitorial at night. And I did that for, like, I think 7 years. So when you do start moving from company to company, it is a little tougher, and you do, so it keeps you on your toes as far as learning the way they work and what style they use and stuff like that. But every job is different. Every company is different, and it varies from week to week. I mean, 1 week you might be digging a ditch or putting in underground piping, and the next week you're in a clean room. I mean, it's very, very unpredictable. But it does keep you on your toes and keeps your mind fresh, I guess. So.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. What are the costs of the program to you? What did it cost you to have to participate? Is that picked up by yourself? By whom? How does that?
The way the program works, and Dave kind of can correct me if I'm wrong, is you sign a contract. Is that how you work for 5 years?
How much? I guess he's at Reverend Johnson. How much does it cost you to be each year?
Is that I think it's it pretty much. Is that just books? So about $400 a year, I think, is what it. I think. $100 of that is tuition.
Your math's off, but you're getting there.
Is it?
I can't. It's not that cheap.
What would you say?
Well, the tuition each student incurs is $200 a year,
okay.
And
okay.
Books run between $400 and $600 a year for each year in the program. And the offset of the training cost, apprentice average training cost is about $6,500 per year, and so that's borne by, again, our apprenticeship contributions from our working men and women in the field. And so every hour they work, part of their compensation package comes back for this facility. So our investment is back into the training of our members and local area electricians as well. So they do carry a share of it, and they do put back with their own contributions, but bulk of it is paid by our trust fund.
Do you have any way of knowing what your completion rate is for those that begin the program and actually get to completion to become,
excuse me, guys,
cross the finish line and become a journeyman?
Hard numbers aren't. I probably couldn't have hard numbers, but I know roughly we're about the 90% percentage rate, because we spend a lot of time and energy invested in actually recruiting and picking the right selected person that will be successful. So we're ensuring ourselves that we're picking the best candidate for the program, that they'll have success in the program. So we anticipate that maybe we might have 1 or 2% drop in the first 2 years, maybe. I mean, it wasn't a suitable position for them. But we highly, I think our ratios, our completion rates, right around 90%.
And I can say, I think there was maybe 16 kids in our class, in the class that I went through with before I left, and I think two or three maybe left, and pretty much everybody kind of sticks with it.
What would leave them to leave the program, in your experience, Nick?
Part of it was the being out of work for so long. I mean, you just kind of get forced out. One is with insurance, or you know, if you need insurance, or you have to find a different job, because if you don't work, you don't accrue insurance. And I think another one, it seems to be is just work ethic. Some people I know just aren't cut out for either trade work or working in the weather or something like some. I know some people were just didn't like it. So.
Yes.
Mr. Co-Chair. During that economic downturn when you had a significant number of folks that you couldn't keep active, is there an on-ramp for them to come back at some point in time? What happens to those, they're not credits, but that training that they have already received, does that have value to them in the future if they decided to come back?
To the Chair, Mr. Cohen, yes, it is. So we're a registered state apprenticeship program, so when they, if they are happen to leave by either voluntary resignation or by other means, then they carry with them related training hours they achieved here in the school and on-the-job training hours on a document from BOLI. And so then they can apply that if they decide down the road to apply for this program or another program, and that will be weighted into their application process. So we currently have two apprentices that came from the non-union that probably hadn't worked in a while for the game. One of them in particular was the economy really wrecked his chances of succeeding to get finished. Mm-hmm. And so now he came back to our doorstep with these related training hours that we had imply and place them appropriately to the related training where they would fit, suited, be best suited for. And so, yes, that does carry with them not only the enhance their resume and application process that they have some skills that we're looking for, it puts them higher on the rank pool to get in.
Okay, so the door doesn't close. Once they're gone, they can come back.
Not unless they upset Mr. Baker.
Yeah, there you go. Very important to note. Yes, thank you.
Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For a beginning apprentice, what would be an average hourly rate of pay?
Through the Chair, Mr. Johnson, all the programs start about $14 an hour, and I'd say about $6 to $8 in benefit package, health and welfare, and pension.
Mm-hmm. That increase during that five-year apprenticeship program?
Yes, all apprenticeship programs have a step increase, and that's kind of the training
based
needs.
Based on number of hours, or how does that?
It's both. And for our program and most programs, I looked at their standards and stuff. You have to complete so many hours in the field, and you have to complete a year or so of related training. So for our program, the first period that they advance past is 1,000 work hours. And then the next period, or every period after that, it's all tied to school as well. So 2,000 hours will be work-related, and they have to finish complete successfully the first year of school, and then it's every school year completed after that. So, again, more skills, more responsibility, more pay, and they take on, again, the role of becoming a journeyman as a progression to that level.
So by the end of their training, what sort of wage level are they at, Dave?
Mr. Chair, I think the inside program, I can go get the sheet. I think it's probably $31 an hour on the check, and then probably about a wage package of 15 to be. I had to be precise. I had to go to look it up, and it's all scaled back. It's about usually 80% or so of what the journeyman level is, so it's a pretty good package.
Mm-hmm. So when a contractor is, you know, planning a job and looking at the mix of apprentices. Are they looking at having a mix of, you know, sort of entry-level apprentices and more advanced apprentices, and does the wage level, you know, come into play there?
Mr. Chair, yes, and I'm not a contractor. I'm sure some of the contractors can speak to that, but that's part of what their overall bid rate would be with anticipation of different levels of training apprentices in there. Most of our contractors carry a pretty even percentage of students in the program, so I like the one general contractor I have right now, electrical contractor. He's got three apprentices in all periods of the program. Throughout every year, he picks up two or three to maintain that level, base level, understanding that as at a lower stage, less experienced apprentice will require a little bit more oversight and time of a journeyman to train them to kind of move that. And as you get a higher stage apprentice, you get to kind of work them where they're actually more viable and turn out a little bit better product and faster production rates. So it's a benefit. So they're trying to do a balanced effect. I think it's detrimental that they don't get, I've had this conversation before, seven brand new apprentices on a job site. You know, it sounds like it's cheap as good, but then you got to have eight or ten journeymen looking them over. So damage can be done quickly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No offense, Nick.
No.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about a floor of you know, percentage floor for public projects, and you know, at least to begin with, a fairly low floor of about 10%, you know, on a job. I mean, it sounds like
10% is something that is well within the range of, you know, what you're used to. You're used to a higher level. But I'm wondering if also we should be looking at what the mix of apprentices is, you know, within that project.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify your question, 10% of what?
I think in the original legislation that sort of provoked this work group, it was 10% of hours worked on a job needed to be done by apprentices on public projects.
Okay, so if we had a public project, and I'm trying not to make this an argument, I'm just trying to. If we had a public project that, say, had 200 journeymen on it and it required 20 apprentices, then our industry would have to be sponsoring nearly 25% of our current workforce just to that one project. The rest of my contractors probably wouldn't like that.
Rod, did you want to respond?
You know, this is the kind of the tricky part is when we look at our economy. You know, I have to admittedly say I don't know how much electrical work our contractors do that's publicly funded work. If I knew that 50% of the work they do was publicly funded and I knew that the state expected to do a certain amount of work in a year, then I could anticipate what our apprentice need would be for sustaining that. The difficult thing that Rich presented was if the state decides to fund some grand project and you want 10% utilization for that two-year project, that could potentially take, you know, 30% of our workforce, and then now we don't have enough apprentices to work on those publicly funded projects. So privately funded. That's the tricky thing, and I don't know where those numbers come from. You know, where I assume maybe that's part of this task force plan is to determine how much work are we talking about, you know, and I think the other thing that's important is we're tasked as an apprenticeship program to provide related training and on-the-job training that's across all aspects of work. That becomes difficult when, again, you get a large project and a lot of people are working on that project. I kind of lost my train of thought there. We have a responsibility really to manage the experience of that apprentice. And so often we're moving apprentices from job site to job site because they've spent an excessive period of time or enough time at one site. And so to just outright commit to a certain type of work, a certain percentage is always going to be difficult. If we're working at a Bonneville power plant, rewinding turbines, that's not a lot of real great work for apprentices. Maybe not even 2% should be on that type of job because of the technical nature of it. Maybe only the highest paid apprentices that would have enough experience. So those are all kind of the logistics of it. That's hard to just say 10% on, you know, every kind of job. It's really hard to pinpoint, I think. I think we need to do research on that.
Ron.
Yeah, I can speak to the Carpenters program. It's a little bit different for us. In general, we got real rough numbers, approximately 6,000 members in the state. Our contracts, all state 20% apprenticeship ratios. It's pretty easy to hit 10% on a job, sometimes a challenge at 20%. We got about 600 apprentices in the state of Oregon. So we're talking about 10%. It works out about 10%. Some of the smaller jobs might only have two or three carpenters. So it's that, you know, what does 20% of those hours look like without exceeding that ratio? That's the kind of the balance. In whole, it shakes out to about 10%. Now, we're always working on that number and always trying to improve the utilization there. And but there, it's just difficulties given some of the smaller jobs and the idiosyncrasies of the industry, I guess.
Dave?
Mr. Chair, also, too, I've never been a big fan of one-size-fits-all, you know, and so I look at it as if we have a training agent request that's from not from our jurisdiction, we call them a traveling training agent. We have certain guidelines about how we dole out apprentices to them. And the factors we look into is, are they going to come in for a year and they want brand new apprentices and then they leave after the year's out? What do we do with those incoming apprentices to keep them trained? And if we have the workloads, we're able to provide that. So if we're talking one or two, that's pretty reasonable. We may absorb those. But we're talking higher numbers than that for our small program. It might be extremely difficult to kind of replace them back out there so they progress through their training and get turned out on time. And it's also difficult, too. It depends on the size of the project. Mr. Robinson spoke to, as I see, is sometimes that it might be a day-to-day process where they go out there for a couple hours, and that's how the man hours for electrical work will be accrued, is over the course of like 7 weeks, they'll be out there five or 10 hours each week. Do they have to drag an apprentice out there with them just to do one item that doesn't only takes one person? So it puts a lot of hard stringent on my contractors to make sure they're providing for that, in my opinion.
Thanks. Yeah, Rich.
Mr. Chairman, I also like to kind of go where Mr. Robbins was talking. Now, I'm going to quote some numbers that came from a previous life that I had, but when I was involved in this kind of stuff, I did some actuarials. Now, we're talking about small shops. 45% of our members work at a shop smaller than 10 people. So we're a 1,200-person organization. I mean, now, grant you, that was 7 years ago. I'm not exactly sure what the number is, but it's going to be close. So when we're talking about those small jobs, it is a challenge, and it's a challenge for 45% of our membership. So just to try to throw some numbers out there.
Yes, sir.
I'm kind of a math junkie, although I can't do it in my head quickly, but I look at the process of if, let's just say, 10% of all electricians on a job site were always apprentices, and it's a five-year process, then after 5 years, every year, 10% of those apprentices become journeymen, and then we would have to replace them with 10% more. And I think if you do the math, there becomes this large mass of journeymen that exceeds the value because there's nowhere for them to work. If we're going to always have 10% of every job site an apprentice, apprentice career is 5 years. A journeyman career is 30 years. And so that 10% all of a sudden becomes this massive, uncontrollable number of journeymen. And again, I haven't done the math, but I'm sure we could do it. And I think you would find in short order the supply and demand would just simply go away. We would have such a huge glut of unemployed journeymen out there. Well, we would definitely have a percentage of apprentices, but I think we have to look at that, is how does this affect us down the road?
Yeah, Dave.
Mr. Chair, also, too, it's a personal issue for, I know all our committee members have licenses as electricians. All our instructors are licensed electricians. And as I came in as an instructor after I turned out in 2000, between 2000 and 2005, I averaged about 7 months a year. And I was grateful to have that. And I went a whole year without working steady, or no, not steady work at all for a whole entire year, calendar year. And as I came in as a director versus as an instructor and assistant, now the director, I can walk down my corridors and tell you the name of every apprentice that's here and probably tell you with a little bit of guessing who they work for. So for our committee and our instructors, it is very personal that I know that someone hasn't worked for 5 months. And to me, the number one goal we have, outside man the work, is keep my apprentices employed and trained. And if we could rotate them around where they see a vast experience of every project that we can get them on, that'd be great. But that's our big commitment to our apprentices, is train them and get them turned out on time.
So, Ron said that their contracts have a ratio built into them. Is that right, Ron? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, 20%.
Yes. Do the IBU contracts tend to have some sort of standard?
No, I think it's calculated based on a as needed and as a scale of market share determination.
I think just to clarify, it's not a mandated 20%.
No.
Go up to
20%. Up to 20%. But we try and get as close to that number as possible. I guess one thing that's interesting about this, and I'm trying to think of some of the non-union programs that exist in the state, and one thing that I'm hearing, hats off to you guys for what you do, by the way. I've been involved in apprenticeship for many years, and it's and it's something that definitely will steal your heart working with these young people. Through their organization, the electrical union, and for us, the carpenters, we network for these folks. So, as far as getting too many, we lose a lot of young kids. They don't complete, or they get distracted, or they, you know, life happens, I guess, and it does for our journeymen as well. So we don't see those numbers at 10%, although we keep trying to improve that, trying to push the utilization number higher. I think it can be higher, but it takes actually stopping what you're doing. Sometimes we're so focused on the industry that we don't stop and think about those things that, you know, apprenticeship may seem ancillary to what the project is on a given day. But I think it's important to understand that the success that their apprenticeship program is having is in no small part due to the network that they have through their business agents and representatives. That I know when we had our numbers, our out-of-work list swelled with apprentices too, and it was tragic to watch people go so long without employment. And people, you can't put them on a shelf and expect them to be there, you know, when you come back for them. So life moves on. But we would work feverishly to keep plugging those folks in, getting them out to contractors that we're hiring or may potentially have work for them. So I think it's that. I think part of the apprenticeship program, it's very important. Without that support group, I guess, of the organization, I think that really speaks to their success, the graduation numbers, and those are fantastic, by the way.
Thank
you. Do you have any idea what your attrition rate is? At what rate are your journeymen aging out at the other end? And I know that changes with the economy. I understand that. McEwen. But are you seeing that dynamic changing?
This gentleman on my left used to have some type of weird math calculation that would spit that out every year. And I think regardless of how much we brought in and whirled and dirled it, I think we were gaining two every year. You know, our membership is about 1,100 strong, I believe. And I don't know if we've done
about 1,200.
I don't think we've done that calculation in quite a while. But I know for several years in a row, it was, I mean, we thought we were organizing like crazy, bringing them in, way too many apprentices. And we had a lot of meetings where some of the seasoned journeymen like, well, if you bring in too many apprentices, we won't be working. And by the time you sit there and calculate a number, I think we gained two people that year.
And same.
Yeah, within our program, we just looked at records not long ago, and we typically have about 104 members retire every year. That was the number. We have about 4,200 members in our local union. So again, I don't know what that percentage is, but so that's a number we use to indicate how many people we need to replace.
Part of your calculation.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. Tom, you had a question or a point.
So geographically, so you out of this training center, you reach over to Central Oregon. You also shared that 1 to 2 and sometimes 3 nights a week they come in for continuing ed. Do you have satellite centers then for, because you talked about prior to here you'd work through high schools and community college and all, so do you have some of that as well to facilitate that evening education?
Through the chair, Mr. Green, yes, we do. We actually are very fortunate to have a partnership with UA, and so the training center that we have over in Redmond, they have given us a classroom or two, and so we have sessions over there. So in Central Oregon, they like their weekends, I guess. I guess we don't like them here, but they do 2 nights a week most weeks, and then the 1 night a week like every alternating one. So they put down about 200 hours a night or over the course of the year, but they do the same time frame that we do. We're just at our Labor Day just before Memorial Day, and we have done some Skype training just recently, kind of play with it a little bit, some training that's more lecture than it is hands-on. And with being in their building, it's a little bit more difficult to have some hands-on stuff we have here, but we collaborate with the director over there. Good partnership that we share space, and you know, we're glad to be a guest in his house.
Find, and I guess this may be be along Rod's end as well, is geographically within the state, is there like some given area that kind of is just like really difficult to, because you don't have enough mass at the given time of work opportunities? And I would just assume that's apprenticeship across the board with everybody.
Yeah. Bend.
I would say everything outside of Portland.
Bend is a good example of an area that boomed for a short period of time, and it looked like there was going to be great demand and a need to build, and people went over there with all the excitement of weekends and everything, and then nothing. And now you can't hardly get anybody to work over there. Yeah.
Mr. Girding, too, also that what we see, we're very fortunate to have two major university systems and three community colleges in our area. And so we're very lucky that we see ebb and flow, you know, of maybe OSU or U of O will pick up where one tails off, or Salem. And so during my term here, even as an instructor, it's very rare that we have a balance of all three districts in the valley that are going at the same time. You know, where Salem might be strong for several months or several years, Eugene might be a little bit lax, then we see it kind of just fill in the needs of where we're at. So I think the difficulty in area to fill would probably be the Ben Redmond area, just because of the work picture has always been kind of slow down there. Residential market took a large hit over there, and that was the bulk of our training.
Yes, Rip Johnson.
So if I'm a small shop owner, and I know somebody like Nick that I'd love to be an employee for me, is it possible for me to sponsor him, get him into the program, and then when he gets through, comes out the other side, have him be a journeyman that works in my shop? Can I have that sort of connection with a student to take them from beginning to end and have them come work for me and maybe one day take over my small shop?
Through the chair, Mr. Johnson, yeah, as long as the apprentice that or the applicant that wants to be in our program meets the same measure everyone else has. So everyone that knocks on our door of interest to be a participant in the apprenticeship program, they've got to meet the qualifications, they have to apply for the program, they have to take the aptitude and pass it, and then interview will be on our rank list. And we have done that before for contractors, either their relative or they're friendly with them, or you know, they grew up with them or whatever. All they'd have to do is just call the training center and said, when so-and-so individual comes up for hire, please give me a call. And we will do our best to place a good relationship out there. Because if we can't have our contractors out there that have a sibling or a spouse or a young one that wants to take over the company, we want to see our contractors have a legacy. And so we're always trying to make that match. And I have no problem fulfilling that obligation. The requirement is, no matter what how it starts, that applicant has to go through the same process everyone else does. That's all.
Yeah, I guess I kind of agree. They have to go through the standardized process. So if you want to recommend someone to our program, I could tell you a bunch of things they should do to make them an excellent candidate. And then they still have to go through the process. And then when they're interviewed and ranked based on qualifications, if they're an excellent candidate, they'll certainly do well. So that really is the ticket, is you can't just simply put somebody into the program, but you can prepare them well, and you can ask for them when they come available.
Yeah,
Chair, Mr. Johnson. And that's where we get the best of our applicants. I mean, I can go out and talk to high schools. I can do career fairs. I can meet people in the street. And the truth of reality is the word of mouth of people they know is they bring people to me and say, this is going to be a great apprentice. And that's where we know that we've got a good one. If we have someone we've seen in our program, been successful, can bring someone to us.
So two things we haven't touched on. Are you getting many of your apprentices from the military, you know, veterans? Is you know, that program of, you know, helmets to hard hats? Or
Mr. Chair, yeah, our veteran status, I'd have to run the number, but I'd say we usually run about 20% of our applicants are veterans. Rich and myself are both veterans. Tim, who's went to the restroom, is a veteran. I think our entire labor JATC side is all veterans, and most of our instructors.
So, and those who are coming in with skills that they've developed through their time in the military, do they get credit for those? You know, is there a way that that's taken into account for the report?
The helmets to hard hat program, what that allows for is if someone has that related training in that field, regardless of their performance on the aptitude test, they get to the interview process. And so we allow that advance to that piece, but we still put them through the interview process. And what we see is, because we know what a DD-214 stands for and what it means. We can disseminate that with every interview committee that we put together. We try to put all our instructors and veterans into a room and balance it. So if there's a question about training, our instructors can handle that. If there's a question about their veteran status or training they did in the United States military, we got people in there that are experienced with that as well. And so we value that very much. All we need to see is what vocational programs they've been involved with or what training certificates they've ribbons they've gotten. We know what it means. And so by talking to them, we can also assess how they interact with a committee, and that's why we usually see them float to the top.
Once they've been selected, is their apprenticeship time able to be shortened because of the work that they've done up front?
Mr. Chair, no. Everyone starts the first day, first role, because even if they were a Navy electrician, they have the experience of what Navy electricians do. Construction is a whole different animal. Now, if they've gone through the program, they've done the probationary period and finished the first year, if they would like to select or come talk to the committee about advancing, that would be their a choice to do. I would work with them to how to ask the question, to provide the documented details, and then they'd have to ask the committee that assessment. And then we have steps for them. If approved, that they would have to make sure they achieve the same level of training to provide proficiency in that before they would advance them to the next level. And it's not uncommon, you know, but... Well, I think a lot of them have that view that, hey, I'm just going to swoop right through this. And after the first year, first month on a job, being around a bunch of rusty electricians, they're quickly put in their place that you've got a lot to learn still. It's a hard process. So I value the fact that I think they mostly realize that after the first 6 months. This is different.
Mm-hmm. And how about the relationship with the community colleges? Are they, does your center have a relationship with Lynn Benton? Is there something that, I mean, how is that working? Could it be better? You know, actually, you and I have talked about this a little.
I'll share it. Yeah, basically what we do is we register all our students at Mount Hood Community College, and Mount Hood's just up the street by 90 miles. And I also sit on the OWIT board, and this is one of a concern I have. And what that allows for, any student that goes through our program achieves about 75% of a diploma and associate's, I forgot what the heck it is.
AOT. It's an
Associate of Applied Science. Now, the tricky part is sometimes that means that they may have to take classes with the Mount Hood Community College or online courses. And what we've been trying to do is to unsilo the systems, because if I have a person that lives in Lane Community area, I'd rather them go to Lane Community College or Lynn Benton Community College or Chemeketa and get the same level of finishing degree that they'll get, because that's a better suited selling point for me. You know, so we do get some money coming back for registered apprentices running through their system, but I can honestly believe that most of our apprentices just want their license, because regardless of how they perform in the college rank, having a license, you can then travel the United States and work anywhere in the field. But it would be a better selling point to me when I go talk to high school kids and parents that not only you get a license from our world, but you can have a diploma from wherever you live in that jurisdiction and 10 courses. And that relationship I'd like to see grow, because it would benefit me and LBCC. If everyone lives in this area, I would encourage them to go take courses and finish their certificate and get their diploma. It's just a benefit.
We'll work on that.
And Mount Hood has been extremely helpful to all of us, all the labor trades.
Are there any other community colleges that you're finding that type of relationship with, or is it just Mount Hood?
The Chair, Ms. McEwen, just to be politically correct, no.
So it's something that we do need to work on.
Mount Hood, I believe Mount Hood hosts all of the union-affiliated trades apprenticeship programs in the entire state. So from Crater Lake to Medford to Tangent to Portland.
I think the open shop potentially has an affiliation with Clackamas, maybe, and I don't know, but I know they do training there. So there may be some smaller agreements around, but there's not a lot outside of that.
Mount Hood is in my district, so I'm pretty happy with them getting all the business.
They're a great partner.
Michael.
No, but I think it's a situation that doesn't make sense for the students, for the workers. So, are there any other final questions for these gentlemen?
Just yes. One quick. I'd like to finish up. You've been here a while.
Yes.
So if you could be king of the world for a day, where do you see yourself in 5 years? What would you like to be doing once you're done?
My job. Yeah. He's taking my job.
Actually, being groomed.
Our life, my wife and I, our life kind of settled down. I think our next plan is to finish up my engineering with electrical engineering within the next, I don't know, maybe 10 years, 5 years. I really think that would be the best thing. So that's kind of my life plan. I know a lot of classmates are excited to turn out and continue working in the job force, I guess. So, but that would be my king. I guess if I was king of the world for a day, I'd finish that up. So it'd be kind of fun, or it will be fun. So,
well, thank you for giving of your time to be here today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yeah. We look forward to checking out your home.
I'll go open up the doors and turn on the heat.
Okay, Pat, you want to come up? It looks like we have some handouts. While we're doing that, Pat, why don't you introduce yourself for the record?
All right. Thanks. My name's Pat Maloney. I'm the president of Tice Electric Company up in Portland, Oregon, and I'm also the chairman of the National Electrical Contractors Association's Joint Legislative Committee here in Oregon. NECA and IBW, as you can tell, are extremely invested in apprenticeship. We currently have 630 apprentices in three programs, inside commercial, limited energy, and residential. We indentured 205 apprentices in 2013 and have already indentured 120 apprentices so far this year. We have nearly 100 training agents. We have the highest utilization of females of all trades with 13.5% and minorities percentage of 12%. We are the only training program in the state with a full-time workforce recruitment director. We invest $2.5 million per year in our training program. There are five separate NECA IBEW training programs in the state, including the one we're sitting in today. We also work with the ACE Academy, Park Rose High School, and Reynolds Learning Academy. We'll host the Women's in Trades Fair this May when we anticipate 650 middle school girls on Thursday, 1,100 high school girls on Friday, and well over 1,000 women on Saturday when the fair is open to the public. We operate on private dollars, and additionally, last year we trained over 3,000 journeymen in continuing education. There's no lack of apprentice utilization in our industry. We are committed to educating and perpetuating the highest level of skill, knowledge, and productivity in our workforce. NECA believes that utilizing apprentices is critical to our industry and the state's future. So today what I'd like to do is introduce you to our concept that we've come up with around apprenticeship utilization. This is our joint legislative committee. This is an issue that we've been talking about for several years, and you know, we've been investigating this and looked at several different models and ways with which we think we can best as a state make sure we continue to invest in apprenticeship, but also don't put undue burdens on the programs like we spoke about earlier. So one of the first methods we looked at was what I think people are calling the ODOT model, where if you're doing a job for ODOT, there is some sort of fiscal incentive that is given to that company that has the contract with ODOT to make sure the apprentices are utilized. When we looked into this and discussed it with our member contractors, we saw a real flaw with this plan, because what was happening is those incentives were being given to contractors who didn't necessarily employ electricians, plumbers, carpenters, people who were actually out, you know, working in the field and investing in those apprenticeship programs. That money was not making it down and flowing through its way to the contractors that were investing that money. It was stopping at a level up above. So we had a real problem with that and didn't think that that had longevity of spurring investment in apprenticeship. It's just money going to the wrong spot and kind of ill-conceived. Another model that we looked at was one that we've discussed today. You know, should we put a flat percentage across, say, all public work projects should have, you know, a specific percentage? If we focus that solely on the public side, and I think Rod discussed this a little bit, I'd be concerned that if we put a limit on that and say we have to have 10% of apprentices in all public projects, our private projects are really going to suffer because we're not going to have enough apprentices to utilize across on those projects, and we'd have to bring them all over to the public side, and those apprentices aren't getting the accurate training they need to be able to do a wide range of tasks. You know, private sector work sometimes is a lot different than public sector work. So if we're funneling all of our apprentices through and making sure we're hitting some sort of, you know, percentage requirement on the public side, they're not going to be ready to go out and work at an Intel and a fab plant and do some of these more complicated things. You know, the other thing we talked about is a smaller shop. You know, we've mentioned that. If we have a flat percentage, are we going to be forcing journeymen out so that they have a specific number of apprentices to meet ratios? And then the second those people are turned out, are those contractors sending them back to the union halls or back to the unemployment lines? And we don't think that makes sense as whatever. You know, another thing Rod brought up was difficulty of tasks. You know, a lot of public work jobs, especially Bonneville Power, working on bridges, some of those things are very complicated at the highest end of our most difficult skill sets that are needed, and those aren't always appropriate jobs to have apprentices on. Those aren't things that you can just train someone to do and then have to go do. There's a skill set that they've acquired going throughout that apprenticeship and then working, you know, on those projects that after they've been a journeyman 5-6 years, they've started to figure these things out, and they develop that skill set so that they're then able to go and, you know, work on the top of the Oregon-Columbia Bridge or things like that. And that brings me back around to our, you know, responsible bidder method, which is kind of an idea that we've come up with and through our committee. Currently, a contractor can be awarded a contract with the state. Before they can do that, they must be what's considered a responsible bidder. Included in that, so when we go and fill out a bid, there's paperwork that goes along with that. We have to prove in that paperwork that we are licensed, bonded, you know, committed to utilizing the building permitting process, and we're going through the appropriate, you know, safety ideas and, you know, as well as the inspection process. So what we've come up with is including the idea that you would be, you know, working as a registered training agent in the state. So our thought there is that would be a commitment by that contractor that they're being involved in a training program. So they are contributing money, they are hiring employees out of that, and what we think that does is that shows a commitment by that contractor and the industry that we are utilizing those people. But what it does is give the contractor and the flexibility of, okay, how are we going to implement across our system the appropriate number of apprentices? You know, we need to say take 10 apprentices and make sure they're on our public work processes, but maybe to make sure those guys are getting the and girls are getting the right education, we need 20 over in the private sector. And it gives us the flexibility to deal with some of the things that we're talking about that are limited by that percentage. So, you know, it would be a very clean and efficient piece of legislation, which is what we as NECA are always pushing for. You know, we don't want complicated things that take lots of dollars to enforce. And, you know, we haven't even talked about how would you go about enforcing the 10% utilization rule. We think this is a perfect way to show industry's commitment to apprenticeship by simply checking a box and filling out paperwork, showing, you know, your proof that you're working with one of these programs that's registered, you know, recognized by BOLI. Make that a part of the bid process. Show that you're committed to the plan, and that will accomplish our goal. So that's the, you know, quick recap of kind of where NEEC is at, and I know you've got a handout that kind of goes into – I mean, there's really not a lot of detail to this. It's a fairly simple concept, but we really think by doing this, you're going to show the commitment that we want to apprenticeship utilization going forward. So thank you for letting me have some comments.
Thank you for that.
Can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
I am a registered training agent. Mm-hmm. I'm in heavy highway, mm-hmm. and I contribute so much money for each hour that my labor works.
Correct.
And so we actually do have this program in place. The problem I have is different types of industry. That's fine for what I do, but I don't know about all the other types of, you know, workers in our industry. And along with that, what happens when they go to the private work? how are you going to get the private people to take these apprentices that have been registered, have been trained partially, moving over to the private side?
Well, it won't change how the – I'm not talking about the apprentices being registered. I'm talking about the employer. So if you're a contractor and doing public work and you're also doing private work, it would just be simply, okay, my public job is wrapped up and that apprentice is available, and it's a good fit for that person to go to the private side. It wouldn't be any paperwork or anything, I guess.
Except I do 95% public work.
So there shouldn't be an
issue.
If they
if they get laid off, they're just not going to continue their training.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
That's where I see a hole. Typically, if I have apprentices, I keep them through the whole process. But it wouldn't work for every contractor.
Can I ask a question? I'm missing something.
Yeah, that's where I...
If they're laid off from you, mm-hmm. then what happens to them, I guess? Why are they not...
I guess that's the question. What does happen to them with the continuation of their training if they go over to the public sector... the private sector, and these contractors are not contributing money, and they're not certified apprentice trainers. These apprentices aren't getting a full load of training, and I think the success of the apprentice is also part of what we're interested in doing.
If I may, Mr. Chair, I think what he's talking about would remedy that situation, because it would open the door for more contractors to become registered training agents.
Exactly.
And that's going to expand your opportunities for
training. So current, if you wanted to bid any public work, you would have to be a registered training agent.
So you only have a few contractors in the heavy highway side that actually do public work. And out of all the contractors, I think AGC maybe 12-15%, a small percent of all the contractors actually do public work. So what happens to those apprentices when they go to private? They're really not going to get trained, because those employers don't have to be a registered training agent.
But yeah, go ahead, Rod.
Right.
Well, I
think the problem is the union versus open shop, because union work, you're going to follow all the contractors in your union base, and they're going to go public or private or whatever, but they're all going to be umbrellaed under union. When you're an open shop, I may do public work, but 75-80% of the open shop contractors do private, and they're not contributing because they're not registered trainers.
So presumably they wouldn't be able to bid on a public project.
But there's only a small percentage of us that do.
But
I guess
to one of your apprentices? You employ apprentices now. So if one of them is unemployed because you just don't have a project, what happens to them today? I guess that's my question.
Typically with my company, because I do so much public, they stay with me through the process. But if they got laid off, then they would have to look for another job with another contractor that does public work, or they're going to go excavating for a five-man shop, and they're not going to get any further training.
But so that wouldn't change.
That doesn't change now. I guess that's exactly with what Rod's saying, is that this doesn't change that fact. There's nothing in this that does that. That would be going a step beyond.
Yeah.
But there's no success with the apprentice program.
Currently?
There's no follow-through with this plan. All we're doing is...
If you mandated 10% though of the workforce on a public job to be apprentices, there's no difference then if in the same situation. So you've made your 10% and you've hired your person and they've worked through the length of that job. When that job's over, if you have to lay them off, that doesn't change. That doesn't fix that problem either. And I don't see how the third option, the Washington option or the ODOT option, that doesn't change that fact either.
I'm not talking about those two options. I am a registered
agent. Correct, understood. So yeah,
I
no, I agree.
And I
That's
pay
a problem.
For registered training. The biggest problem is the biggest base of the open shop workers that don't do public work are not going to support any of the training that we've spent the money on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, presumably, the approach that you're proposing, Pat, would incentivize contractors to do the right thing.
That's exactly right.
Right. Well, what would be the penalty if they don't? I mean, what if they bid on a job because they've got, and they are a training agent? They have a good track record, but on this project, they don't follow through.
Well, I guess I'm confused, because if you're a training agent, you're in the process of doing that throughout. So you're saying if they bid a project while they were a working training agent, but they fell down on their duties throughout the length after the contract is awarded? Because I think what we're talking about is at the beginning, making sure they're actively participating, show proof that you're, you know, a registered training agent. And but if you're saying, are you saying then like halfway through the job, they stop that program?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm just wondering how the oversight works now. If
correct,
you know, presumably a training agent has to perform to certain standards.
Well, and absolutely. I mean, that's Boley's responsibility, from what I understand. That they make sure that those training agents, as well as the IBEW NECA Training Center, they make sure and they're checking in on their training agents. I mean, Rod, can you talk a little bit about how that happens?
Yeah, we get audits. We have to turn in reports, monthly reports, and so forth. So, I think that's covered. I didn't think of this until this conversation started. We have 129 training agents, I believe. Probably 30% of those employers hire most of our apprentices. With Pat's concept here, I could see some of our smaller shops that hire 10 or less people would all of a sudden see a benefit in actually employing apprentices on a regular basis, because then that would make them eligible for public works. Whereas if Pat's model was put in place, we may have a training agent, but if they haven't hired an apprentice in 3 years, technically I would think they wouldn't be eligible to bid that job.
Correct.
So in my mind, it would bring up the percentage, because it would promote some of those, you know, as Sandy mentioned, some contractors that may want to dabble in that environment. This would be something to promote them getting apprentices, so when that opportunity comes along, they could dive in and no issues.
This is Kathleen. So, just a question. I'm assuming, so the responsible bidder would fall to the general contractor that's bidding the contract, but how would that fall to the subs? The subs wouldn't be responsible for being training agents prior to bidding on a contract.
Currently, yes, you are. When you as a subcontractor, when you provide your information and your quote to that, you have to prove that you are, you know, you have your CCB license, that you have workers' compensation. You have to prove all those things to work on a government contract. You have to be a responsible bidder. What we're saying is add it the additional piece.
Not the subcontractor, the general contractor.
Correct.
You could,
I guess, on a project, let's say if you had, you know, percentage set up where you had to meet a certain percentage of apprentice hours. The general contractor would be responsible for ensuring.
Well, I think it's fairly simple. It could be required in the bid documents to say that all subcontractors that you employ on this project will be responsible bidders, you know, that they can provide proof that they are, you know, have their CCB license, are properly licensed, and are a registered training agent. It's as simple as just adding that clause, I would think, in your bid documents.
Right. So I guess, you know, why do you have to show, or why couldn't you get registered as a training agent prior to award of the contract? Why do you have to do it at time of bid?
I would say that the idea here is that you are it beforehand, not, you know, that we're incentivizing contractors to become registered training agents and participate in the program. We're not just trying to make this, oh, I want to bid on this project, I'm going to sign a piece of paper that says I'm a registered training agent, and now I can go bid on that. That's not the goal here. The goal is to try and get more, a wider group of contractors, both generals and subs, to utilize apprenticeship and to train. And we think this is a valid way to do that. We're broadening our scope so that if you want to play on in the public sector, that you do that, that you do those things. And I don't think we're advocating for this to be a checkbox that you fill out a piece of paper, you know, the week before you're going to go bid on a big ODOT project. That's not what we want, and we need to make sure that the legislation, however it's phrased, has language as such.
Right, and I don't think the apprenticeship programs are set up where you can drop in. I mean, from what I've seen, the majority of them are not set up where you, as a contractor, can drop in and out of the program.
Exactly.
Most of them have a minimum commitment that the contractor has to adhere to.
Exactly, and that's the point that we're trying to make.
Well, I get that,
but regardless of whether or not you said somebody needed to be a training agent at the beginning of the, you know, before they bid or not, they're still going to be subject to those minimum requirements as far as registering as a training agent.
Correct.
But there's an expense to being a training agent.
Right.
You don't go in and out of it. You are a training agent, and you are required to do certain training and contribute. There's not enough public work to make it an incentive for someone to have to contribute funds. They'll just avoid public contracting.
Well, Tom, you had a point.
Yeah, I think if I don't mean to try to steer the boat away from this. I think that, first off, if we go back to the whole, the big picture of apprenticeship and what's at task here, and today's meeting is an important step in our education process. If we step back and look, there are several things we've got in our apprenticeship. We've got the trainers and educators. We have the employers who hire the apprentices and the workforce, right? And then ultimately we have the workforce that are being trained, whether they're in the program now or whether they're seven-year-olds that hopefully we're going to be able to attract to get into the industry. And this is a premier training facility. I'll also state that we were blessed enough to get a build it. So, but anyway, I just want to step back holistically. I think that there's clearly this is a union training center. You know, there are open shop training elements out there as well. Open shop educators and trainers and apprentices going through open shop programs. And I think it's important ultimately for we to also sit down and hear from that piece. And then the third piece is I think, and again, we have mixes of all of that right here, but to focus on those is ultimately the employers. You know, and here we have one right here that again crosses over union open shop. I'm union. Let's hear the open shop side. I say all that in that we need to get the education piece because we've jumped in here and now we're trying to potentially solve an issue and we still don't have the education, I don't think, in place for us to really look at. And this is great dialogue, but apprenticeship, as we're starting to see, and those of us in the industry have long since understood, it is a complicated process. We could have these meetings once a month for eternity and continue, because I mean also as things evolve within all the systems. So I guess I just jump in on that and say, while this is good dialogue, I don't want to get ourselves off and start, this is my opinion, getting off on things when we still haven't really gotten our education process in place to really understand, because I think when it comes down to it, this may not be accurate. I think when I come to this, I try to take my personal and business hat off and put an industry hat on here on behalf of AGC. And I think we were all asked to come to a task force with our collective experiences and knowledge, not to banter, and I'm not saying we are, but elbow around to protect our own position, but hopefully to bring our collective knowledge and collaborate to how are we going to address this? Because again, for you know what we heard earlier, statistically amongst the trades, for every four that are leaving, we have one coming in. We've got a huge problem. We are just starting to crawl out of this economy, and we've got workforce constraints right in our face. What about we have sustained economy pullout? I mean, workforce shortages, you know, we've got this big, huge thing on apprenticeship. And I guess I just want to make sure, you know, rather than getting into something on this as we're hearing the whole thing, who's doing what great and how do we expound upon that? What things are broken, aren't working? And we all honestly talk about that. And within the component of the task force, we look at all of those pieces so that, you know, we don't come out winners and losers. And in the next session or 2 years from now, you know, here we are again in front of you all, and you guys are frustrated because industry's in front of you talking two different things, right? I mean, this is the chance collectively to get it fixed. So I'll quit pontificating, but I mean, that's just a piece I guess I want to bring to it, is I think that we still have a lot of education to look at, and hopefully we all look and collaborate. Obviously, we all got to still protect our turfs and sorts of things, but the big picture here is we all got to come together to grow our industry and to grow those coming into the apprenticeship. And we're all under the big tent and workforce image and all of those sorts of things.
Yeah. No, I appreciate those comments, Tom. And, you know, I think, you know, obviously our goal today is not to give a thumbs up or a thumbs down to responsible bidder. But I think, you know, I do appreciate the number of sort of issues that have been raised just in the last half hour, you know, but that this has created a framework for. And, you know, I think that's useful. These are all things we're going to have to be addressing. And
I apologize. I didn't mean to start shutting it down.
That's fine.
You had it out, and it's there and for us. But I started sensing it's getting to a point like trying to resolve it.
Yeah. Carl, and then. Okay. Carl, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had just a simple question. In your idea of this model, then, for the responsible bidder to be a registered training agent, then do you have an idea of would a qualification of meeting that definition of a training agent be a certain number of apprentices? And what I'm getting at with my question is, if you're a training agent, and that's a qualification to meet as responsible bidder, where do you bring in the component that makes your not only are you a training agent, but you are employing apprentices?
Correct. And you know, I'm not the expert on what the definition of a training agent is. I mean, Rod, you know better than I do.
Well, I mean, Carl's got a great question. And that's what triggered in my mind is we have training agents that are registered training agents, but on a normal yearly basis don't employ apprentices because they do service work and whatever type of work they do, they typically don't. I guess if I was king for a day, I would say, look at your annual number of employees, and if you annually employ 10 journeymen over the course of a year, then you're required to annually employ one apprentice over the course of the year, and that makes you 10% compliant. Therefore, you're a registered training agent in good standing, and you could bid publicly funded work. I mean, that's my simplistic view of it, and maybe that's not practical, but that's where I would start, I guess.
And you're correct. I am a training agent.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
I am part of the JATC for Inside Electrical, and we have a parallel
same thing
situation where we have people who are large training agents who routinely employ large amount of apprentices. But then there are those that they'll have one, he'll turn out. Their business model maybe is something where they're not really interested in a growth pattern. They're interested in just maintaining. They like where they're at. And they won't hire another apprentice until somebody either leaves their employment or retires or something else. So they're on again, off again, and there may be 3 years. Yeah. They're a training agent the whole time, but they have no apprentices. So that's why I was just thinking it is on here, because for me, what I'm really passionate about is workforce development and apprenticeship and getting as many people in that path as makes sense. And so I would want to make sure that there would be a component that you can't just be a training agent, you've got to participate.
I don't think that's anything we would object to.
John, and then.
No, I think we're getting to some really interesting discussions, and I think one of the things that I keep coming back to is, from this task force perspective, what are we trying to fix? I think we all need to think really hard about that, is what are we trying to fix? And I agree with Tom, is that we still got a lot of education in front of us, and there's multiple paths that we can choose. And everybody in this room, and anybody you walk down the street, you say, what do you think about apprenticeship? It's the greatest thing in the world. But it's always when you get down to the details, it's more difficult. The reason I'm kind of intrigued by Mr. Bologna's idea is because I can see where a public project could have problems hitting the numbers, and through working with Kathleen and the City of Portland and their workforce training and hiring program, which is 20% apprenticeship utilization with further focuses on women and minority. And there's been times at publicly funded projects in Portland where we've really struggled to get the numbers, because how do you tell a single mom that's working 5-10s out at Intel and she lives in Hillsborough or Beaverton that she should quit and take a 40-hour-a-week job at a publicly funded project for the City of Portland or a PDC project? So that you get reverse pressures going from the private to the public and vice versa. So when you look at it from an industry perspective, and you have apprentices on public projects and you have apprentices on private projects, if you look at the totality of the apprenticeship workforce rather than one sector or one project, to me that seems like a more holistic approach of looking at apprenticeship and what's right for the apprentice. Right?
Yeah, as the lobbyist for NECA, I wanted to just sort of address one of the things that Mr. Gersh brought up, because the intention of the previous letter from last time and this letter from today was actually not to try and get the committee to support the responsible bidder approach today. The statutory charge in linking to 782 that passed was specific to a utilization requirement on individual public projects. There was nothing in it that says that the committee here will review alternative approaches to enhancing apprenticeship. This was trying to get your guys' sort of interest sparked in looking at other avenues outside of sort of the narrow focus of a project-specific utilization requirement.
Yes, right.
I mean, just to be clear, the responsible bidder language, would it or would it not require apprentices on public contracting?
Yeah, no, it wouldn't. It would require that every contractor that's bidding a project for the for the government would be a registered training agent and participating in a program. So you're right. No, I don't think that this language with this responsible bidder isn't going to say, hey, you have to have X percent on each project. No.
Yeah. The reason I lean towards requirements is, and Kathleen can speak to this. She's I've worked with her a lot at the City of Portland. Is, Portland years ago they did this disparity study and looked at, this issue of minorities in the trades, women in the trades. I mean, most of us, I can tell you our numbers as carpenters, I'll be vulnerable, or our numbers look horrible. Now, they're in areas where I have requirements. We can meet those numbers and we can actually exceed those numbers. And it's helping us to change as an organization and look more like the communities that we live and work in. But without those requirements, what happens is those individuals have a job for that project, but they don't have a career. And without a career, they fall out of the program. And so that's really for me, that's the problem, is that it'd be nice if we could just have, a responsible bidder. I agree with the concept of it. And in a perfect world where folks were responsible, and we'd all expect them to be, that problem would solve itself, but that's not the world we live in. And we do need requirements to have actual change.
Well, and that's what I think we're trying to do, is to solve it in the totality, is not just to say exactly what you said, hey, this project has this many, needs this many apprentices, because then if that's the case, those apprentices are only going to be employed as long as they are on that particular project. By doing a responsible bidder model, you're making contractors commit themselves to the training, the apprenticeship model, and that they are going to participate in that model. And by doing that, we're hopefully carrying that across their entire spectrum, and we're not dictating this particular project has to have this many people and this one has to have this many, and that we go back and forth. We want, with this model, we want commitment that state-funded projects are being done by contractors who are doing it right and are participating in apprenticeship. I guess that's what I'm trying to get to with our responsible bidder model. And we can dictate and go back and forth about some of the specifics on that if that's the way we want to go. But that's where we're trying to go with this, is we want full commitment across the board to you're a registered training agent, that you're participating actively in those things, and that you're doing things the right way, and that you're not just hiring a certain amount of guys to stuff on a job, apprentices to stuff on a job to meet a requirement and move on. So that's our counterpoint to that.
I appreciate that. I'm sorry, Rip Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You began your presentation with being critical of the ODOT model of using some financial incentives as a way, I think, of encouraging apprenticeship utilization. It's been a long time since we've heard ODOT testify. Were you there then? Was that prior to about the time we were doing the shakeup?
Yeah, that was the very first meeting.
We heard from ODOT about how it's working, and my recollection was that I think the goal was maybe 10% on ODOT projects, but they're actually exceeding that, I think. Mm-hmm. It's closer to 13%. So I guess I'm curious why we would feel like you'd want to discredit that out of hand so completely as a model if what we're about here is trying to grow, increase the numbers of apprenticeships that are being used on public and private projects and so forth. But it seems to me like they do have a fairly successful record to look back on.
I think our concern there is that financial incentive directly leading to apprentices being trained, or is it is that money getting to the apprenticeship programs? That's my concern, is it's not getting there. And yeah, maybe we're maybe they're getting a result, but is it market driven? Is it something else? Because I can assure you that money isn't trickling down to the subcontractors, in my opinion, that are doing those jobs, that are funding and paying money into the apprenticeship programs. That's my critique of that model. Not to say it might not be driving something, but I think you can be a lot more effective.
Back to the overall charge here, which was trying to increase the levels of apprenticeship, mm-hmm. so that we have the workforce needed as our economy expands and as the journeymans and those folks that have been in the trades are retiring and dropping off. Workforce development is what we're about here. Yeah. So again, I would be reluctant to throw it out. There could be some ways maybe to tweak it.
That's right.
But to simply throw it out completely as something that could have merit and could actually bring about the kind of results we're looking for as a state, I think would be premature.
Okay. Yeah, we were just trying to present another method. I think the ODOT model in its current state to our organization doesn't affect the change that I think we need to make that above and beyond change, I guess is how we phrase that.
Okay. Don, did you want to?
I'll save it later when we get deeper into the weeds of specific proposals.
Great. Well, Pat, thank you.
Thank you very much. Sir.
Thank you for putting this on the table for us. The next item on the agenda is looking forward to future agendas.
That was lunch.
I'm just saying, lunch.
I think we have, we've heard a lot today that has been, very compelling and really we're going to have to be, that's going to take a lot of discussion in the future. I mean, there are issues related to values, issues related to, understanding where we are today and, how we can improve the status quo. The core value of trying to build off of what's working today as opposed to totally reinventing things. I mean, to what extent can we do that and make any legislation that comes out of this as simple and, you know, as Pat said, efficient as possible? I think those are all attractive attractive things. In terms of what we want to, you know, cover in our future meetings, you were all asked to come in with some thoughts about, you know, what you want to make sure is on the table for the next meetings. And so I'd like to hear your thoughts about that, you know, building off on what you heard today, and, you know, what we need to really make sure, you know, is on the table. And then talk a little bit about the schedule. So, first of all, Rep. McEwen, did you have anything that you wanted to bring up?
Well, I just think this has been a very valuable conversation. I'm probably the newest to the table of anybody that's here. You're veterans, and I very much appreciate your expertise and your different viewpoints. This has just been very educational. I think I'd hearken to what Mr. Girding had to say. It's good to get in the weeds a little bit, but I think we need to continue to have a really big picture, and in our next meeting or two, bring those different viewpoints in so we can get that education that we all need to, as we culminate this thing, figure out a path forward. But I'm just very pleased at how we're progressing with people's engagement in this conversation, and look forward to our next meeting when we can continue on down this path with some different ideas.
Rep. Holby, did you have something?
Yeah, I'll go to the microphone since I know you like to have things on the record.
From some people.
Yeah.
It's probably a shared sentiment.
Be nice to my colleague, Mr. Co-Chair, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, Paul Holby, State Representative of District 8. You know, and I really appreciate listening to the conversation. It's really good conversation. I want to go back to just something that Mr. Girding did bring up. And I've been involved in this conversation since 2003, actually, and it was Dan Gardner who was bringing this concept forward at the time. And there's been concepts like this ever since then, trying to do something about getting more people into the trades. The economy sort of took a downturn, which gave us a little breathing room from time to time. But I just wanted to, you know, and you're all probably aware of this, and I think Mr. Girding kind of made reference to our workforce challenges going forward. The recent statistics from the Employment Research Department have shown that the growth in Oregon's economy is improving substantially over the next 10 years. And in fact, in the construction industry will be the fastest growing portion of our economy. And it's going to grow by 29% in the next 10 years. And I saw Mr. Sims walk in, which made me think of this. Our apprenticeship programs turn out, I think, over the last 14s, an average of 1,200 apprentices every year. So if you do the math on that specific, just that piece of it, you know, our construction industry has about 80,000 workers in it, and 29% growth. You're looking at needing about 24,000, 25,000 new construction workers over the next 10 years. That doesn't even speak about attrition, doesn't even speak about the average age of carpenters or other trades is alarmingly high. The average age of apprentices is kind of high as well, you would think. It would be down around 20, 21, but it's closer to 30, you know. So, I mean, we really are facing, you know, a potential problem, and I think the big picture of this is it's in the state's interest as an owner of projects to make sure we have a workforce that's skilled and trained and, you know, can deliver good quality projects on time in the future. So, you know, that's really sort of the big picture item. And so how do we get there? I appreciate the a proposal coming forward from NECA. It's a constructive way to look at the industry. They have some different challenges in the electrical world and different aspects than like the carpenters or some of the unlicensed trades who apprenticeship serves in a slightly different way. But I just think we need to keep in mind that, you know, looking at the big picture, you know, and what our needs are going forward. And currently it is state policy in our public contracting laws to encourage the use of apprenticeship and encourage apprenticeship training. And our state, through our public contracting laws, really doesn't accomplish that other than allowing apprentices to be paid less than journeymen. So that's sort of a big picture I just wanted to leave you thinking about not just the 29% growth in the industry, but also attrition at the same time. We really have a lot of people that we need in the future, and what's a good way to get there. So I appreciate all the work and all the participation. Thank you.
Thanks. Yes, Ron.
Yeah, on some level, I'll echo what Paul said there. I mean, I remember what brought us all together was this impending crisis. I mean, the demographics of the situation, if you study those, and I find those numbers kind of fun sometimes, although alarming, we are faced with a serious problem, and it's compounding. If we don't, get a requirement on public contracting, I guess it just presents more challenges for those existing apprenticeship programs to try and fit the need of the industry. If we do, I feel like we can at least put some wind in the sails of what seems like sometimes an uphill battle for apprenticeship programs in the state, because there's a cost to those things. It is a lot of work. It isn't easy to provide opportunities and mentor young people and invest in that education to turn them out to an industry that a lot of times doesn't appreciate that investment. One of the things on this committee that intrigued me was that we were going to take and see what worked around us. And I'm kind of pragmatic that way. I don't have to always be reinventing the wheel. I appreciate the work that's been done in other states. And so reviewing Washington's process, however flawed, what it did was over years and years, and I have colleagues that worked on that in Washington, and over years and years, they came to the point where, they needed to move the ball forward. I think that's where we're at in Oregon, too. I think there's an awful lot of incentive to move the ball forward. Now, maybe the Washington model is it, and maybe it isn't. I think it's a good, personally, I think it's a good starting point. But I think for us to get distracted with some of the ancillary things, and there's plenty to get distracted with, and not do something positive that actually creates opportunities for apprentices. I mean, I see it again and again in what I do, and it's networking for young people or journeymen or older workers too, to keep them employed and keep that family afloat. That if there's not consistent opportunity for these folks to not just complete their apprenticeship program, but continue in the trade to the extent of a career, that all that money is wasted, all that hard work is wasted. And so I hope whatever we, wherever it goes from here, that we don't stray from the goal of getting something done for apprenticeship in the state of Oregon. So thank you.
Yes, Barry.
Co-chair, thank you. I'm looking at all of this, and there's, Oregon has a huge amount of small employers. Small employers, very small. And we do a lot of work. Besides big projects, we do a lot of small projects. And we're promoting minorities and women-owned businesses, which is all great. I'd like us, if there's a way in the future to kind of look at how we could encourage the apprenticeship in smaller businesses, because I see that huge amount of work that's a total of quite a lot of money not even being part of this. And that kind of, it's a good opportunity to start growing that sector Because most of the workers start in small employers and then they grow into bigger companies and they hire more people. So there's a lot that we could miss, because I know it was originally thought of as like a million or a set amount, and there's a lot of jobs that we do at DAS that are much smaller than that, lots and lots of work.
Point.
Yeah, that's a good point. Carl?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For me, what I really want to make sure that we keep in our focus here is kind of a push-pull type of a thing. We're trying to pull people into a program, into apprenticeship. We also need to have the push on the other side. You know, I was fortunate that the first shop class I took was in the seventh grade, and I took those classes all the way through high school. And then I did some college, and after that I went to work as a carpenter. Because of those shop class experiences, and what we really need to make sure we accomplish here is getting back to that, because the more people that are interested in coming into these programs will result in a simplification process. The more volume that comes through, the more people that come in, the more people will be mm-hmm. interested in taking advantage of mm-hmm. it, because it becomes the normal thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. I have a gal who works for me now who desperately wants to be in the apprenticeship program as an electrician. She's been waiting for 8 months. Now she starts considering her options to do something else. So there's a person who came interested, doesn't really have the education in that area because didn't have the high school, junior high, any of those sorts of things. So when she applies and she got into the program and she got on the list, she didn't place high enough up the list because she didn't have that earlier background. And I think we can solve a lot of this problem if we get more interest in apprenticeship by the young people coming out of the schools, because let's be honest, there was a lot of diversion going on at the high school level, at the high school counselor office of, well, you know, you need to choose between Oregon State or U of O or wherever it is and sign up for one of these type of programs. If we can accomplish apprenticeship being looked at an equal or better than option for a lot of people, a lot of this problem will go away, because it will become normal to have more people come to work at companies as apprentices.
Michael.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure that we've worked very hard in the last couple of sessions to not only create but fund the career tech education revitalization program. And we're still constrained by the amount of money we can put into that program. I think we're up to about 42 high schools that have received grants out of 390 or so. I don't know, Mr. Sims probably knows how many applications came through. Yes, so we're funding about half of the folks that want to be involved, and it's something as a state that we need to continue to keep our eye on that ball, because you're absolutely right. That exposure at a young age is what creates that open door in that pathway, and we've been remiss in not supporting that well enough in the past. We took our eye off the ball as a state and as a nation, and we need to focus back on it. And I think we're doing it, but we're not doing it at a robust enough level yet. So I mean, I think there are those of us who understand the importance of it, we'll continue to fight for it. But like everything else, it's a budget issue. How many million dollars can you put into it? We need more. But I appreciate you drawing attention to it.
Well, don't get me wrong, I do recognize there's been progress made.
But we need more.
Recently. And,
absolutely.
You know, so it's a good direction. So my comments are really about stepping on the gas pedal, yep. And I understand the budget constraints, yep. And those sorts of things. But I think the more we keep pushing, as we have for the last few years, yeah. The more success that's going to come.
And we need all you to get behind and keep pushing, too, because that's what it takes. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'll leverage off of that. Brought along, didn't know if it'd be an opportunity to bring it up. I'll just pass them around. Just, it's an FYI to get on at AGC, separate from our AGC website. We started a campaign, Build Oregon, that focuses on the construction opportunities out there. And we have a website, build-oregon.com. And I'll pass these around, and it's, I think on it, I'm not sure whether we've got reference to all the varying
trade associations and all within it? Do you know? We don't. I know on our AGC website we do, but
it's focused on individuals.
Yeah, I mean it's not. It's completely non-political. It's trying to be hip. It's something to direct to the youth to look at and see. It's got some video stuff. It's got, you know, of what's in the trades. And I know there's other, especially amongst the varying union associations and all that have their varying campaigns. But I mean, I think that's all part of our image campaign. That I mean, that's the cool thing. We're all under the big tent here. That when you strip it all down, I mean, we're all have one, I think, 100% consensus of we need to grow our both our image campaign and ultimately to the benefit of growing our workforce. So anyway, that's just a little
thanks,
plug
Tom.
I toss
yes.
out. So.
No, absolutely.
Mr.
Yes,
Chair, I'd like to just make a comment that this is a really complex issue. And, you know, you hear from certain trades, electrical, plumbing, carpentry, I'm heavy highway. I just feel like there isn't going to be a really fast answer to try to fix this. We could always mandate something. Okay, we did something, and here it is, and everybody has to do it. But I'm hoping that this committee is actually here to do something that's going to increase apprenticeship and that it's going to be good for the apprentices, that they're actually going to be in a program and be able to learn and be equipped to be really good workers in the future, because probably 40% of the kids today coming out of school are not going to go to college. They are going to look for other venues, and to have it in the trades, it's been wonderful probably for everybody here that's been involved. And so I would just like to see a real successful program, whatever we come up with. And saying that, I go back to Tom with the education. I think we still need to hear from a lot of other entities, small business perhaps, and some of these other things, so that we can really educate each other about, you know, where everyone is coming from with this issue.
And that's a perfect starting point. I know we're kind of interrupting around the table. We'll continue that. But what we need now are those entities that you want us to bring in to educate us. Mm-hmm. So besides the small shops, who else do we need to bring in to help us better understand where we're trying to head?
You know, I'm not familiar much with it, but I understand maybe, and it's kind of a central hub of the Mid-Valley, but Temecula has a number of programs associated with the trades that I think is primarily, though not primarily, if not everything, associated on the open shop side. But I don't know if anyone has a relationship with Temecula that we could maybe a next meeting get set up there and hear from those trainers and educators, and maybe some that are going, you know, what's their process for the different ones getting into the apprenticeship program. And
maybe we bring Mount Hood in at the same time. It sounds like people have commented.
I think so. I mean, I think it doesn't have to just be the Chemeca. I think it's a place we could meet, we could hear from them. We could then bring others in from wherever. I think, you know, Northwest College of Construction, they have a program up there. He could come down, Dan Graham, or whoever. I'm not sure if Dan's still there or what, but
I think he is.
To come down and talk and you know, just hearing how the other side on open shop does it in comparatively. And I think that would be maybe a great next landing spot.
Yes, Carl.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I like the idea of Chemeca. I participate in their program, and so I know that they have good facilities there. They have apprenticeship for electrical and plumbing and mechanical and many other programs that I'm not aware of, and perhaps we could do something to where we could have, they have an apprenticeship director for those programs, and perhaps she could get representatives from each of those apprenticeship programs to all be there at the same time in the same place, because their labs are all together in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
I think we need some more education on registered training programs that are outside the unions. I think somebody, you know, from that area would be nice to hear about what are the requirements and, you know, how many people are registered training agents and et cetera.
Great. Yes, Rob.
Well, as I sit here, I'm thinking one of the biggest barriers to growth of apprenticeship is really having employers contact the local programs and ask for more apprentices. You know, admittedly, we have our own contractors that don't hire apprentices for whatever reason. In my simplistic world, it seems like it's a given that if you have somebody that makes half as much money, you're overall composite rate would be less, so therefore it's a good business model. But obviously that's not the opinion of all contractors, and I guess I think it would be nice to encourage people that are working on publicly funded jobs, perhaps, that aren't using apprentices to come to this board and explain why not. Because I'm not sure what the barrier is. I mean, I can see that we can create some rules, and we'll figure out what those rules are, but at the end of the day, I'm not understanding why people are bidding these jobs and they're paying full journey wages and they're not willing to bring in somebody to train them to replace their workforce if there's such a concern.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Yes.
Yeah, I think my thought is that, you know, looking down the road, you know, as we put a track, so then maybe that's then the meeting after next, is that we bring in a broad mix of employers and reach out and try to get that. You know, I mean, you think about, you know, the small group that's got four employees, and at any given time they may have one person on each job, and you're not going to send an apprenticeship out to do a job. Or, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of complexities in how does that all look. And again, I mean, I think it's to all of our benefit, and I'm certainly talking to myself, to try to bust out of a preconceived notions, to really be open-minded, right, to be hearing, again, what's going good, what's not going good, that's not going good, why, and try to peel the onion back to figure it out. And so the more people we can hear from in that and hear, you know, open shop contractors saying, you know, they haven't got access to apprenticeship program period, and therefore it's, you know, it's a 20-year-old company and they've just given up on apprentices, when maybe there's an apprenticeship opportunity at a community college next to them and they're oblivious to it because it's been what they've been doing. And
right.
I mean, you know, there's probably all sorts of different sorts of things, but anyway, so I would think that, you know, then we can be thinking about that maybe that's a meeting after next, is hearing from the blend of those that are hiring the apprentices and those that can share the great stories, fantastics of how it's working, and those that why it hasn't worked for them.
Yeah, that sounds great. John?
Yeah, I'm just going to agree with some of the folks that went before me, from Sandy and Carl, saying, you know, let's have a Shemeca and hear from that side of the industry and what their issues are, and from Tom as well. Now, we're in Anika IBW facility today, and we heard from Anika rep, but there's a lot of other signatory contractor associations, you know, for the sheet metal contractors, for the mason contractors, for the plumbing and mechanical contractors, that all have a little different perspective on life and how this industry works. So I don't know if that's the meeting after the one at Shemeca, or, you know, how we're going to accomplish this in the amount of, you know, agenda times that we have left. But I think it's important to hear from them as well.
Mm-hmm.
Walls and ceilings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that sounds good. I mean, it sounds like we have a few meetings worth of content. You know, what I would like us to also be doing, just from my perspective, is, you know, beginning at the next meeting, starting to identify sort of those values that we all agree on. You know, I mean, I think we've touched on a lot. You know, we've heard that we want to increase the number of apprentices, and we've heard that, you know, we want to diversify the, you know, the apprentices, you know, in various ways, including regional, you know, diversification. I'd like to see us kind of formalize that, and, you know, see, okay, what do we agree with in terms of the values, and then what what do we agree with in terms of where we want to wind up in meeting those values. The specific legislation or whatever it is that we come up with, I think we're still some months away from. But we do have a deadline that we do need to think about. The legislation formally gives us a deadline for a report in September.
November.
Okay. If we want to do legislation, we would need to have something done by the end of September. But it doesn't need to be a finished product at that point. We can just have something that's sort of a placeholder bill for that. So November then is really our real target. But that does give us time, I think. Our next meeting, our May meeting, we can, it sounds like we want to do something in Salem, maybe at Chemeketa. We had been thinking that we could coordinate this with our regular legislative committee meetings, which are at the end of May.
30th would be, I think it's a Friday afternoon, Patrick?
It's Friday afternoon, yes.
That's correct.
So if that sounds okay with people, that would certainly be convenient for all the legislators.
They're gone.
So is this,
I won't be here for May Ledge Day.
Maui.
Kauai.
Costa Rica the next morning, so get me out on time.
I'm learning how to frame it.
Budget to have the meeting.
Yeah, we'll follow.
Yeah. Apprenticeship program.
I don't think
we'll can we do that? We can.
Yeah,
convene in a nice.
Oh, there it is on the Monday.
So we can get a lot accomplished in a tropical environment. Don't you think?
Right. Well, anyway, Patrick will work on
surveying on offline on that. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Great. Patty, was there something you wanted to bring up? Or,
no, I'm good. I think this was a very valuable discussion. I had a flashback, though, I wanted to, when Mr. Girding was speaking about taking off your hat. I was a school board chair for many years and chaired a budget committee. And every year there was one person on the committee who came in with a hat firmly tucked down on a very specific issue. And every year we had a conversation about everybody checking their hats at the door. And it was very telling that you recognize that that's important for all of us to do and put forward in these conversations what's best for the apprentices, what's best for the state, and what's best for the industry. So I appreciate your comments, but my flashback to my woman who liked a softball team is very fresh in my memory. It was all about softball.
Yeah.
Can't function yet, but budget committee didn't function that way. So thank you for bringing that up. Yeah.
John,
I just want to thank Dave and Rich and everybody with 280 for hosting us here today and Nick for taking the time to come and share your perspectives. It's my understanding, Dave, you're going to lead a tour here of the facility for anybody that can.
About 25 minutes.
Okay.
Wonderful.
and I regret I can't stick around. I've got a board meeting that actually started at 3 o'clock that I've got to call into as I'm driving to my next destination. But I've been in this facility many times before. It's a beauty.
I left Portland this morning.
All right. On that note, I think let's adjourn this meeting and move on to the tour or to our next meeting. So with that, we are adjourned. We are adjourned. Meeting. So with that